Highline Radio, where the magazine that captures the spirit of the Bow Valley comes to life. Here are your hosts, Aaron Moroz and Christy Davison.
Hi, and welcome to Highline Radio. I'm Kamara.
And I'm Alan, and we're filling in for Aaron and Christy.
This week, with fall upon us, we'll talk with the executive chef of Banff's Spies and Restaurant, Grant Perry.
But first, Kathy Burden from Parks Canada is here to fill us in on recent fires in Banff National Park. Hi, Kathy. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Alan.
So, it seems that fall and maybe actually winter has come to the Bow Valley. Does that mean the end of the fire season?
Well, it definitely slows things down. We definitely have a chance for a rebound in the fall. We typically have, you know, can have some nice and warmer Octobers as well. So we'll have to see what will be for this year. But, you know, we're not saying that the fire season's over at this point, but it's definitely slowed things down quite a bit for us.
And now, is that just wildfires or is that prescribed burning or both?
That applies to both. And we just had finished up some operations before this cold weather came in at the Mount Nestor prescribed fire. And so that actually timing was quite good because now we can use this sort of colder weather to let Mother Nature help extinguish the fire naturally.
And is that something that you count on or, you know, would you have been trying to put out the fire as the cold weather came anyway? Was it just good luck? How did that work?
Well, usually they try and plan, you know, that they do their ignition before a large downturn in the weather. That's ideal. And then that way, if there's any kind of actions that they have to take to kind of put out some areas of the fire, you know, then that is going to be greatly reduced of their actions that they'll need to do if they can time it properly.
So let's talk a little bit about Nestor now. Mm-hmm. We had some beautiful fall weather, you know, got up to the, you know, mid-teens, 20s maybe even, and you guys took that opportunity to light some fire. How'd that go?
Yeah, actually, we had 26-degree weather, which was just amazing, and we definitely need those types of conditions to reach the objectives we're looking for. So I think sometimes people wonder why we're doing burning when the weather is nice and it's hot and dry. It seems kind of counterintuitive, but we're actually trying to meet fire objectives, so we actually need weather to be hot and dry for us to even go out and attempt it. So there are, you know, there is a certain prescription that we're looking for, certain weather conditions with wind, with temperature, with the moisture that's out there in the vegetation. So there's all these factors that have to align before we can even consider it. So we had an opportunity there when the weather was nice. There were about 4 days of burning towards the end of September. And that was, you know, reasonably successful as far as a fall operation.
Now, is fall more difficult to burn, easier to burn? Does it make a difference?
It always, of course, depends on the weather of that year. But typically in the fall, it gets a little bit more difficult because we have the days are getting shorter, the days are getting a bit colder. So those types of things factor into a fall prescribed fire. But when we do have the opportunities when the weather is nice, then it can be quite, we can meet objectives because we've also had the whole summer of those, the vegetation drying out if it has been a kind of a dry summer.
Right. And now it sort of sounded to me like, you know, people were saying, you know, you got a fair amount of burning done at the Nestor fire, but Nestor's, the prescribed area is huge. Percentage-wise, did you really get much done?
Definitely, it was, you know, that we burned approximately 1,000 hectares of the unit, but for the entire area being, you know, 9,300 hectares, that is, you know, a small portion, really, but we've been working on it over the past 3 years, so we're slowly kind of taking out chunks of areas, which is, you know, not necessarily a bad way to go, but typically, you know, at least with this prescribed fire, we've been limited by the weather conditions, and I think interestingly, for this area, it's probably the highest elevation prescribed fire that we've done. And so those are a whole new sort of set of conditions that we're working with. And when we get higher in elevation, now we're looking at wetter conditions and colder conditions. So it's definitely been a challenge, and that's why we're continuing to work on it.
Yeah, like one thing I've heard is that it's just wetter there. And, you know, we've had nice, beautiful days here, and you'd think you'd be able to burn, but, you know, you've had rain and snow up in the Mount Nestor area. Was that anticipated before you decided that this was going to be a good place to burn?
Definitely a lot of it is kind of learning by doing and being in that area, and it doesn't really matter what the weather forecast is saying. If you're not on the ground and seeing what's happening, you just don't really know what that area is all about. And so we do have a remote weather station set up near that area, and that can give us some more accurate details about what the conditions are actually like near the site. But I think they're even finding, because it's such a large area, that that one weather station isn't enough to predict accurately for all areas of the unit. Particularly in the Bryant Creek area, we were seeing that it was quite a bit wetter.
Interesting. And now, it's been 3 years. Is there any forecast on how long Nestor's actually going to take? I mean, I know it's weather dependent, but, you know, any guesses?
Well, I think what happens now at this point is that, they have to assess what's gone on this year as well as what went on in the past years as well, and see how far they are along in meeting their objectives, and then kind of reevaluate and reset their objectives for the following year. And that's actually coming up now in October, because this prescribed fire is actually a joint endeavor with the province of Alberta. So we're working with Alberta Tourism Parks and Rec and also Alberta Sustainable Resource Development. And so with those three agencies, we need to get together, and that's happening the middle of this month, to kind of review all of that, what went on, and reset objectives for following years. So that kind of, the answer to that is really going to kind of come out of this upcoming meeting.
Right. And along with the prescribed fire at Nestor, we also had a wildfire up at Mount Malik. Can you talk a little bit about that? What happened there? Is it lightning strike? Do we know?
Yeah, definitely. The ignition source for that is presumed to be lightning. We did have a system go through that area kind of previously, but a lot of times we'll get lightning in an area, especially when it's remote. It'll take a long time for us to even be able to detect that it's there, for someone to notice it and alert us. So that's sort of what happened with the Mount Malik fire. It was probably smoldering around in that area for quite a while before it was actually detected. So we responded to that fire, or went and looked at it on September 14th. That's when it was discovered. And what happens is that not all of fires in all areas of the park are responded to in the same way. And the park is mapped out so that, we will respond to fires and try and suppress them right away in areas that have like high human concentration, high human use, lots of valuable infrastructure, say in the Bow Valley. Those types of wildfires we'll put out right away because it's a public safety concern. But other areas in the park, we have a little bit more room to be able to let some of those fires grow to, grow to a bigger size and achieve some, ecological objectives where it's not, threatening any kind of values at risk.
Right. And that's because historically, if there was, a lightning strike, the fire would have just burned, right?
Yeah, exactly. We want to give fire the chance to have its historical cycle. And so because of the area that we have in the large remote kind of backcountry area, there are some places we're able to do that. And such was the case with the Mount Malik. It's in a monitoring zone for the park, so we're able to assess the fire, and what they do is they do a pretty full assessment on the weather, the current conditions, what they anticipate for the fire to be able to do, the location. They pick out all the kind of values they're worried about, and they make a plan basically. And so they're able to kind of draw some circles around the fire and say, we're willing to let this fire get to be this size. If it crosses this boundary, we're going to take these actions, and so on and so forth.
And now, I'm guessing a lot of people don't know where Mount Malik is, because I certainly didn't before I was looking into it. Can you just tell us a little bit where this is and how remote it actually is?
Yes. So the Mount Malik area is in the Clearwater area of Banff National Park, which is sort of our northeastern corner of the park. And so I guess if we drew a line from, say, the fire to Rocky Mountain House, the fire would be about 90 kilometers southwest of Rocky Mountain House. So it is quite remote in that region. But we are close to our boundary from there, about 6 kilometers from the boundary. And so that is, in our mind, a value at risk. We need to protect our boundary from fire moving from the park onto provincial lands.
Right, absolutely. And now we're coming up to winter. Does that mean you guys just sit around? Because, it's hard for a fire to go wild in the wintertime. So what all do you guys do in the winter?
Well, with the Mount Nestor and the Malik, we're going to continue to monitor those fires right now. So we've had definitely a lot of help from the colder temperatures and some of the precipitation that we've had. But we'll need to continue to monitor those fires because there is still active fire in those areas. And I think specifically for the Mount Nestor, we have opened those areas for day use hiking, like in the Bryant Creek. But people need to be aware that there's still active fire and there may be smoke lingering or smoke generated if the days get warmer and, into winter here. So So that's just one consideration. But as far as the rest of the fall and winter, we, you know, do a lot of work planning for the upcoming, for the next year. And so our, you know, fire managers and crews will be working to plan prescribed fires. They're also working on a lot of fuel reduction projects this winter. And so that's just an ongoing thing that we do. And it's to help try and reduce some of the vegetation in key priority areas around our communities.
Cool. Sounds like it's a never slow time for you fire folks. Thanks for taking some of that time to come and talk with me today, Kathy.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Up now, we've got Mountain Licks. Here's Chakra with their rendition of Log Driver.
If you ask any girl from the parish around what pleases her most from her head to her toes, she'll say, I'm not sure that it's business or yours, but I do like a waltz with a log driver. For he goes purling down, down the white water. That's where the log driver learns to step lightly. It's purling down, down the white water. The log driver's waltz pleases girls completely. When the drive's nearly over, I like to go down and watch all the lads while they work on the river. We know that come evening they'll be in that town, and we all want a waltz with a log driver. For he goes burning down, down the white water. That's where the log driver learns to step lightly. It's burning down, down the white water. Log driver's waltz pleases girls completely. To please both my parents, I've had to give way and dance with the doctors and merchants and lawyers. The manners are fine, but their feet are of clay. For there's none with the style of my log driver. For he goes burning down, down the white water. That's where the log driver learns to step lightly. It's burning down, down the white water. Log driver's waltz pleases girls completely. Now I've had my chances with all sorts of men, but none is as fine as my lad on the river. And when the drive's over, if he asks me again, I think I will marry my log driver. For he goes burning down, down the white water. That's where the log driver learns to step lightly. It's burning down, down the white water. The log driver's waltz pleases girls completely. The log driver's waltz pleases girls completely.
That was Canmore artist Chakra.
After the break, I talk fall cooking with the executive chef from the Bison Restaurant, Grant Perry.
Highline Radio will be right back. Now back to Highline Radio. Here are your hosts, Aaron Morose and Christy Davison.
You're back with Highline Radio. I'm Kamara.
And I'm Alan, and we're filling in for Aaron and Christy. Well, with fall finally here, I can already feel my appetite changing. To find out about how fall changes what we're interested in eating, I'm joined in the studio by Grant Perry. Grant is the executive chef at the Bison Restaurant here in Banff. Hi, Grant. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't we start off by learning a little bit about you, sort of where you're from and how you got into cooking.
Okay. I'm originally from Toronto. I grew up in a small town north of there called Beaverton. So small town roots. So obviously moving from Toronto to Banff was a bit of a shock, but I had to kind of revert back to my old ways of the small town living when I got here. Started as a dishwasher like a lot of chefs do. So not really glamorous there, you know. I'm not going to make up fantasy stories about that, but started as a dishwasher, then got into cooking very shortly after that, and started cooking when I was about 14 and a half, 15. So I've been doing this for a few years now.
Yeah, really? Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And have you done training, I'm assuming, over the years too? Or
yeah, I'm a graduate of George Brown College's Culinary Management Program.
Cool.
Yeah.
And so was cooking something you were always interested in, or did that start with the dishwashing?
It's always something I was interested in at home. I don't think it really came to fruition until I started working. It was something that I could work and be paid for, and like, hey, that works out. So, yeah, so here I am.
Cool. And what brought you to Banff?
To open up the restaurant. I got a call from a friend of a friend, said, I'm looking to do this. Are you interested? And came out here and checked it out, and here we are 4 years later.
Wow, that's pretty neat. It's got to feel good to be, wanted and have somebody say, I want to start a restaurant with you.
Yeah, I mean, it was completely out of blind faith. I didn't know Ryan, the owner, and he didn't know me, but, we worked together, and here we are, very successful.
Yeah, the Bisons get some pretty good reviews and stuff, too, so it must feel pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
And so, before we talk about some recipes, can you talk a little bit about the Bison and sort of the way the restaurant goes about doing its cooking, because it's a little different than some places?
I think first off to say we don't open any boxes. The old joke that I have when I hire people is I hope you're ready to start cooking because the only thing I buy is mayonnaise and sliced pickles. And they kind of take that back and they go, oh, really? And then they think, oh, this guy's got to be kidding me. When they get into it, it's like, oh, really? I really do have to make everything from scratch here. So I think that's what separates us from the pack for sure. Also being a very busy restaurant, more chefs are inclined to start buying in pre-made items, and we really haven't done that at all. We've just stuck to our guns and said we're going to keep going with what we're doing, and it might be a bit harder sometimes. It might be a couple more hours, but the end product is far better.
And the end product is fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
And you also use a lot of locally sourced products. Does that affect how you cook?
It definitely is an inspiration when it comes to menu writing. Our menus are really seasonally driven. For instance, the other day when it started snowing out, we had some very summer-oriented items on our menu, and we went, no, we got to change it. So that very day, we had to change those items very quickly. But doing that, it wasn't like, oh, we need to order in all these things. It was, no, we have all these great products that are ready available to us right now that just got dropped off. Let's get them on the menu.
Well, and, talking about that menu change, how does cooking and eating change when fall or winter, whatever we're going to call it these days, comes about?
Really, your produce is affected. So to buy locally, is kind of tricky because we do live in the mountains and we are in a park, and I don't think there's any farms in the park. So that obviously changes things. But as local as we can, local suppliers, I'm on the phone to 4 or 5 different farmers a week when purchasing proteins and stuff like that. So we really cut out the middleman as much as we can to really support local farmers and their families.
And so when fall comes, how do people change? How does what they want to eat change?
You really start seeing some heavier main courses, that's for sure. People want to eat a bit more, depending on when daylight savings time comes around. It affects when they come in the restaurant, when they leave the restaurant. Now it's getting darker and darker out early. So they really start wanting more heartier dishes and but the local theme is still in tune there. They still want to have something local.
So for people who are going to cook something at home and they're sort of wanting some, maybe a little heavier meal, what kind of stuff would you suggest that people look at doing?
Well, if you're into veggies, the Okanagan produce is pretty much ramping up right now. All their peppers are, this is a great time for peppers. Their tomatoes are kicking around still. All the soft fruit's pretty much done. You might get your hands on some nectarines and things like that. Pumpkins and squash, definitely those traditional, heartier root vegetables are definitely going to be a part of the menu, things that you're going to eat at home.
And so can you share a little secret, something that people might, want to try cooking up that they might not be used to doing? Like, what's a good way to do up some of those, heartier vegetables?
Vegetables aside, we can talk about proteins as well. A lot of people are kind of playing with bison as opposed to beef. So that's something we're seeing definitely as a trend. People are replacing that now as opposed to traditional beef. So if bison's available, definitely try that. It's going to be a little bit different to cook. It's a very lean meat, but really tasty, very healthy. And then you can pair that up with whatever vegetables you like to have. Traditionally, however you make them. I wouldn't boil the hell out of all of them, but obviously you can try some new cooking techniques to, you know, really just jazz up what you're normally used to.
And I don't want you to give away any of your secrets, but, you know, cooking up bison, what do you need to, what should people look at doing differently?
Like, depends on the cut of meat. Braised items do take a bit longer, need a lot of moisture. Low and slow is the idea here. You don't want to cook things really fast and hot. You want them to be, you know, slowly braised in the oven. Generally, any roasts and things like that, you can cook them as you would normally, as you would a beef roast. Steaks are pretty much the same as. Just, you're going to find they're going to be a little bit different. They're not going to have as much fat in them, so they're going to be a little denser to cook.
And now, it's, you know, Thanksgiving time and people probably have some leftovers. And now I know in the restaurant you don't cook with leftovers, or I'm assuming you don't anyway. But at home, you still probably end up with that. Yeah. What kind of things can people do with some of their Thanksgiving leftovers?
Well, I'm a big fan of turkey sandwiches, so that's always a good one. Soups are always good because you can freeze them and they last for a long time. So you can make a turkey soup out of all your stock or out of your turkey bones that you've got. You know, you can make a lot of, you know, pot, like casserole type dishes, I suppose, with your leftovers and make those kind of things. I don't know. There's a lot of raw materials there to work with, whatever. Well, it's personal taste. I think every family's a bit different.
Absolutely. Any, you know, is there anything, if you were making a, you know, a turkey, you know, like a roast or like, sorry, the a pie type of thing afterwards, what should people think about throwing in there that they might not normally have thought of?
What would they put in there? I don't know. It's a bit of a tricky one. I have to see what they'd have left over first.
I mean, you can go out for a certain specific special item if you want to throw in. Is there some seasonings that you find work really well that people don't always think about?
Try adding a bit of curry to your turkey. See what happens there. People have chicken curry all the time, so maybe a curried turkey could be a new hit on the post-Thanksgiving circuit.
Absolutely. It definitely could be. Now, before I let you go, any last thoughts on fall cooking you want to leave people with?
Buy local. You know, a lot of these root vegetables and things that you're going to get are going to last you a couple weeks, probably, depending on how you store them. So, I mean, you can very easily go to the local fruit truck. And if you're into preserving them or canning them, whatever you like to do, and now's the time to really get into that.
Cool. Well, it's been pretty interesting. Thanks, Grant, for stopping by and chatting.
No problem.
So, Alan, what's your favorite thing to do with Thanksgiving leftovers?
Well, I'm pretty lazy, so generally I tend to just sort of stick them in the microwave. Because really, they taste good the first time, a little warm up, you know, it works fine for me. What about you?
I have a pretty big family, so I don't get much leftovers that trickle down to the end, but there's a little bit of stuffing that I'll usually eat the next day.
Yeah, you like the leftover stuffing?
Yeah, it heats up well.
True enough.
Well, if you have a great leftover recipe you want to share with us, give us a call on the feedback line at 403-762-1536 or email us at info@highlineonline.ca.
Don't forget you can catch all the shows on the podcast at friendsofbanff.com. Plus, check out the latest magazine at the website highlineonline.ca.
Thanks for listening. Make sure you tune in next week for another Fix the Highline.
Highline Radio from the creators of Highline Magazine. Visit them online at highlineonline.ca.